Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Saeeda Varsi.
I'm David Baddiel, and welcome to A Muslim and a Jew Go There.
And this week's podcast, we finally got to it, is the Q&A. You've been sending us questions for many, many weeks, and today we're going to answer them.
Yeah, now it's exciting because we've had loads of questions and we've waded through them all and we've chosen the ones that we think are the top ones to sort of ask each other. And the questions have gone there without any doubt. The questions aren't really soft questions about what's the nicest meal you've ever had, David, or what's your favourite colour, Saeeda? No, they're not like that. They're about Israel, Palestine and Jews and Muslims.
Blue.
Yeah, of course it's blue. You're still a Tory at heart.
I'm going to kick off with the first question, which was from Danny Young. And he said, I'm going to read out his question. As an old agnostic white man, it's hard to understand why individuals or communities get so fired up over their religion or ethnicity. So it's good to hear the arguments from different perspectives. When it comes to racism in the UK, I've heard relentless verbal attacks on Muslims and Islam over the years, and I rarely hear anything like the same vitriol about Jews or Judaism. And the question he asks at the end of that is, do you agree that Muslims are exposed to far more racism in the UK today versus Jews? What a question. What do you think, David?
So thank you for the question, Danny. So the first thing to say is it's not a competition, as many people have said over the years. So racism and discrimination shouldn't be league tableised, even though communities can end up whilst defending their own position and drawing attention to whatever hate comes towards them. They can often be accused of that. But it's important to say, A, it's not a competition. B, the type of racism that different communities face might not be exactly the same. On that point, I would say definitely Muslims face more, A, because there's far more of them. There are, I believe, 4 million Muslims in Britain, as opposed to around 270,000 Jews. And the other reason, which we did talk about very briefly, actually, on the first ever episode, which is, of course, most Muslims, not all of them, but most Muslims, like Saeeda, are also people of colour. And people of colour will get all sorts of racism. And my sense is, from the way that Saeeda's talked to me about it and just from understanding it, is that there's an overlap between the type of racism that you would get, Saeeda, as a person of colour, and that you might get as Islamophobia. And unless a Jewish person is a Jewish person of colour, which of course very much exists as well, but unless that is the case, then they're unlikely to feel that.
Yeah, I think that you're right. The statistics actually, interestingly, probably bear out in exactly the same way, particularly since the 7th of October and the fallout of what's happened in Israel and Gaza. According to the Community Security Trust, which is a Jewish safety organisation, there were 2,699 anti-Semitic incidents that took place on or after the 7th of October up to the end of 2023. And this marked a 589% increase on the same period the previous year. And interestingly, Telmama, which is an anti-Muslim reporting organisation, had similar statistics between the 7th of October and the 13th of December, where they recorded 1,432 anti-Muslim cases. And this marked a 634% increase on the figures of the previous year. I think we both accept, don't we, that since the 7th of October, both anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim Islamophobia incidents have been on the increase quite dramatically.
Yes, we both, I think, agree that obviously since the 7th of October, there's been an increase in different types of attack on both communities. I would be interested at some point in some kind of breakdown of exactly the nature of these attacks. I'm very concerned mainly about the ways in which some of the attacks on the Jewish community, inspired by what's happening in the Middle East, cross that boundary, which is for me the key boundary, between genuine protest and anger about what's going on in the Middle East and just attacks on Jews because of the association of Jews and Israel, and may obviously involve attacking Jewish shops, Jewish people who have expressed no particular support for Israel. And I'm not sure that, whilst I completely accept that attacks on Muslims have gone up, I'm not sure there is that particular discrepancy, although there might be. There might be. I've no idea.
I think what I find interesting is that it's, if you look at the number of attacks on Muslim communities and Jewish communities, for me, the interesting part of that is how do we respond to that? And the people who respond to that are those in power. So that's the police, that's the politicians, it's policymakers. And I think going back to Danny's question, what I think is different is the kind of acceptable racism, anti-Muslim racism, Islamophobia, which is spouted out by politicians and spouted out by newspaper headlines, I think is far more commonplace. There was a really powerful statement made by Robert Peston a couple of weeks ago when Lee Anderson, the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, was talking about Sadiq Khan. And he said really powerfully that when Lee Anderson had said that Sadiq had been taken over by Islamists, that had he said they'd been taken over by Zionists, the prime minister would have had no hesitation in turning around and saying that is anti-Semitic. But actually, I find that where there is acceptable Islamophobia in the way that there isn't acceptable anti-Semitism is in the corridors of power and also in editorial kind of headlines and newspaper front pages.
Yeah, I mean, this comes back to something we've said a lot, which is I think you shine a light for me on the prevalence of Islamophobia in the corridors of power. I think because I don't exist in the corridors of power, I see much more Israel-related, often anti-Semitism. So, for example, online, there's a constant reference to Keir Starmer being in the pockets of the Zionists, of specifically financially controlled by them. The fact that at the start of this conflict, he said some things which were seen as too pro-Israel and which a lot of people in the Muslim community got upset about, I see all the time that being referred to, not necessarily by Muslims, by mainly white progressives, as an example of how he and other people are too much in the pockets of a notional Jewish power network. And obviously on the far right, by the way, that is extreme. It's a very interesting thing. I don't think I've ever seen the banal observation. It is a banal observation that there is a horseshoe between the far right and the far left at present in terms of how much both the far right and the far left are going on at the moment about Jewish media, Jewish power, Jewish control of the narrative, which there really, by the way, isn't, because the thing that I see or just endlessly is an utter failure on the part of Israeli supporting Jews to control the narrative. It seems to me that Israel is a pariah amongst most nations, and almost everyone who looks at the papers, looks at the telly, including Jews now, think that Israel has failed to present a good case for the way that it's gone about what it's doing. That's aside from the overall ethics of it. It just has lost the PR war, which seems to me to be counter to the notion that Jews control the media narrative.
I think what's probably interesting, if you look at the question, is do you agree that Muslims are exposed to far more racism in the UK today versus Jews? I would say that I live in the right part of town. I'm not visibly Muslim. I'm a social mobility success story. Do you think you and I, David, are quite privileged in the sense that although we hear a lot about anti-Muslim racism, Islamophobia and anti-Jewish racism, anti-Semitism, but actually we're probably not, other than online where we both get a whole load of grief, we're probably not on the receiving end of it in the same way that, say, visibly Muslim and visibly Jewish people are?
Well, certainly the Orthodox community, you're absolutely right. And that might be the same in terms of people in the Muslim community who dress in a very traditional way. The Orthodox Jewish community are constantly under attack. And that is not because people who want to attack them are very angry about the Talmud. It's because those are the Jews who are wearing their Jewish insignia out loud. And some people confuse that with their anger about the Middle East or whatever else it might be. And so those Jews get attacked. The only thing I would say is, from my point of view, is that one of the things that Jews get thrown quite a lot is that, well, Jews can pass, and I can't pass because everyone knows I'm fucking Jewish. I've made too much of a fuss about it, and thus, if I go anywhere, I'm quite likely to get people saying something about me being Jewish. And the most interesting thing about that, Saida, which is a whole other conversation, is I get a lot of people saying stuff about me that is anti-Semitic, but that is meant to be friendly. Right? I get quite a lot of people will suddenly say, oh, David, oy vey, they'll shout at me or something. I mean, non-Jewish people or stuff about money or whatever else it might be. And a lot of time they think, just being friendly, aren't I? Because I know he's Jewish.
What does oy vey mean?
Oy vey, just, well, you've never heard oy vey?
No.
Have you never heard it?
I've never heard okay. oy vey. No, what is it?
Okay, well, that is an example of how Jewish control of the media has failed, certainly in your area, because oy vey is probably the most root one Jewish sort of expression. And it just means, I used it, I think, on our WhatsApp group quite recently. It just means, oh,
yeah, I actually
dear.
Did, but like, I actually thought that was a typo.
No, it's a really famous Jewish expression, which just means, oh, no, essentially. Oy vey, it probably means something like, oh, God, or something like that. There is a more recherché version of it, which is oy gewalt. But now, very early on, we're teaching each other language, and normally we do this later.
You see, I just thought it was something from the northeast because they got oy a, don't they, or something. Now I'm going to upset everybody on the northeast.
Oy vey is really, it's the most, like, if you were writing a two Roddies sketch about Jews, you'd have one of them saying oy vey. It's very cliched, but it is used.
I'm really glad you taught me that, you know, that I have learnt something. Right, do you want to move on to the next question?
Yes, let's move on to the next question. I'll read out the next question. Now, the next question is a really big one, and I chose it because I thought, he's done it, this bloke, and he's called Phil Mitchell. I don't think he's the one from EastEnders, but he might be. He might be thinking about the Middle East conflict the whole time while he's in the Queen Vic. Oh, no, he's identified himself as a progressive Jew from the US, which is definitely not one of Barbara Windsor's sons. And he says, Phil, the question no one seems to have an answer to is, how can Israel protect itself from Hamas without causing a catastrophe in Gaza? And actually, the reason that I chose that one is partly because it goes to the heart of a lot of things that we have tried to talk about the Middle East, but also because you talked in a couple of podcasts ago about how for terrorists in Britain runs into a shopping centre, we don't nuke the shopping centre. And of course, I agreed with that. And I generally agree with the horror and the awfulness of what's happening in Gaza. But I do think that I haven't heard anyone say who might believe that the hostages have to be returned and that Hamas have to be certainly destroyed, or if not destroyed, they have to be taken down. How do they do that then? How would any army do that, given that they have, in Coleman Hughes' words, Coleman Hughes is this very brilliant black podcaster who was on Joe Rogan's show the other day, given that Hamas have spent 15 years embedding themselves in the civilizational structure of Gaza, how do they do it? And by the way, I don't have an answer.
I mean, it's a brilliant question, isn't it? And I think what it does is it draws on two separate parts, really, to try and answer that. One is, why is the war happening? And second one is, how is it being conducted? And I think when you say, how can Israel protect itself? That's the big part of this question. How can Israel protect itself? Well, it can't protect itself by dealing with the symptom. It has to deal with the cause of the war. And the symptom of the war is Hamas. The cause of it is occupation. And ultimately, as I keep saying, and I go back to this over and over again, the only way we will have a safe Israel is when we have two states side by side, both sovereign states. Because even if we say the worst happened in Gaza and Israel went in and absolutely demolished everything in the Gaza Strip and killed everybody in the Gaza Strip, I'm telling you, we would just end up with another version of Hamas, because Hamas is a symptom of the ongoing occupation. I think we can have the second part of the question. I mean, I think we can genuinely have a conversation about how the war has been conducted. How precise has it been? How many people have been killed? How does it compare to previous wars? I was looking at some statistics, actually, by Oxfam, who went through previous wars and said that the death rate certainly in this one was higher than any other major 21st century conflict. They compared it to the number of deaths a day and compared it to, for example, Syria, Sudan, Iraq, Ukraine, Afghanistan, Yemen, and the death rate per day was higher in this particular conflict. They also compared it to deaths in previous wars between Israel and Gaza, and again, it was higher. And I think if we look at the biggest story over the last 7 days, the aid workers who were killed, the number of medical workers, aid workers, members of the press that have been killed in this war, again, have been really disproportionately high.
So I'm going to have to stop you, because I think that's obviously all true. What I'm interested in is the first part of the question. And your point about the symptom is interesting, because if you have a disease, you have to deal with the symptom. Then you perhaps go and deal with the underlying cause, but you have to take something to deal with the symptom. And in the situation that exists at the moment, which has a number of multiple causes, which without any doubt Israel is at least co-responsible for, certainly co-responsible. There are other parties involved as well. But the situation exists, which has created Hamas, and they are in tunnels underneath that originally civilian place. And I still don't know what the military solution to that immediate thing is. It may be the case, I believe Matthew Paris in The Times wrote a piece which I thought was quite interesting, in which he said the best thing to do after October the 7th would have been for Israel to basically do nothing, to just like accept that this had happened, it was a terrible thing, and to sort of suck up the tragedy. Because in the end, what they've done doesn't work, and also has created this, as I said earlier, pariah status in the world. I feel that would have been very difficult to do when there are 253 or whatever it was at that point, hostages being held in Gaza. But maybe that is what they should have done. But I...
You see, if I had to advise
I still haven't heard an answer. Sorry, my point is, Saida, what I mean is that obviously there should be a solution to the occupation. Obviously, that should probably be a two-state solution, monitored in whatever way a two-state solution should be monitored. But these are very wide issues. I think what Phil Mitchell is asking is how, in the immediate situation, could Israel protect itself from an organisation that is there with guns, with rockets, that does want to destroy them, but has embedded themselves underneath Gaza? How do they do it? And I don't know what the answer is. I'm not saying the answer that they're doing is the right one as well.
You see, I come back to this. This is all about the protection of Israel. It's not about the protection of Israel for today. It's about the long-term protection of Israel for it to have a secure state. And unless we tackle the cause, we will always face the symptoms. If not Hamas, it'll be another group. I mean, if you look back to why Hamas was created, the people who founded Hamas, they themselves were people who were excluded and pushed out of Israel in the 1940s during the Nakba. So the root causes of this will always ensure that there will be recurring violence. And if civilians are killed and people lose their family and people lose their children or people lose their parents, all we are doing is creating another version of Hamas for the next 10, 20, 30 years. Even Israeli generals have said you can't deal with Hamas in this way. And the fact that one of the most well-resourced armies in the world with the Israeli army has been at this for 6 months. And after 6 months, we've got over 30,000 people dead and the hostages not returned. And they're still negotiating with Hamas, clearly shows that the way they're trying to do it hasn't worked and it hasn't made
Israel
any safer.
I agree. So what should they do at this point? I don't mean what should they do in the long term, for which I also agree with you. There should be a negotiation, there should be two-state, etc. What should they do at this point? Do you think they should just withdraw, say it was a mistake?
No.
What? What should they do right now?
Yeah, right now, for the first time, they have the whole world saying there has to be a negotiated settlement. There has to be a return of hostages. There has to be a prisoner swap. They have to have the US, the UK, the European Union, Qatar, Egypt, Jordan. These people have to be around the table. And there has to be a whole world answer and resolution to this with a clear sense that a political solution has to come at the end of this ceasefire. First of all, there's going to be a ceasefire. Before anything else, David, there's going to be a ceasefire.
I guess one thing I do think is that there are all sorts of parties in the Israeli government who are invested in this war. Let's say they were removed, which would be a good thing, and a more moderate government replaces them. I am still not convinced that Hamas will come to the table and do that negotiation. Not really. I believe that Netanyahu doesn't really want to end the war for political purposes. I also think Hamas doesn't really want to end the war for their purposes. And I think that we have to accept that both parties, when you talk about like what should happen now, both parties have to come to the table, and they seem to be keep coming to the table, and it keeps collapsing because both parties are extreme. So if what I'm saying is if Israeli became less extreme, I'm not... When are Hamas going to become less extreme?
Well, they became less extreme about nearly 20 years ago.
Now.
No, but let me just say this to you, David. I've got to say this to you, right? Because this is why, unless you deal with the underlying cause, this will never stop. In 2004, Hamas agreed to end the armed resistance in exchange for recognition of Israel and recognition of Palestine on the 67 borders. They also offered Israel a 10-year truce. The people who offered that were the original two co-founders of Hamas, Ahmed Yassin and Aziz al-Rantisi. And what happened was, this was offered in January of 2004. By March of 2004, both of them had been taken out by targeted airstrikes by Israel. They were both dead 3 months later. So they will. What I'm saying to you is that people will always find a reason on both sides not to have an agreement and not to move towards a political process. But I think if the UK, the United States, the European Union, the other countries involved were to clearly say that going forward, all our engagement with the Israelis and the Palestinians will be conditional on both of you making progress within a specific time frame for a two-state solution, I am telling you, we would start to see progress. But when we do not have any consequences to both sides breaking that commitment to a two-state solution, that's when we continue to allow the root causes to fester.
Okay, so two things there. One is, you've come up with, as you often do, a very specific fact about the history of Israel-Palestine that I'm sure is true, but that I don't have the counter for because I don't have the information that you have on your fingertips. And what I have instead is a woolly thing that I read many times about how various Palestinian groups have rejected attempts by Israeli negotiators when there have been less extreme governments to try and create solutions. So it seems to me that the rejection of solutions, as far as I understand it, happened on both sides.
They have. I mean, I can confirm that, David. I agree with you.
Okay.
That at various times, both the Israelis and the Palestinians have not taken advantage of that moment where they could have made peace. Because there was a time when the Palestinians said, no, we want all of what is now Israel and what was originally Palestine back. And the Israelis are now saying, no, we're not going to give you any of it. So there have been moments when both sides have not been prepared to go for a two-state solution. What I'm saying is, the only way you will hold their feet to the fire, both sides, the Israelis and the Palestinians, is if we, the United Kingdom, the United States, the European Union, those that hold the power, those that provide the finances and the weapons, clearly turn around and say, from now onwards, everything that you do will be judged against your movement towards a two-state solution within a time frame, and we will make our relationships conditional on that. The reason they are where they are is not just because the Israelis have failed and the Palestinians have failed, David, but because we have failed them.
The only thing I would say about that is, I agree with you in terms of the long-term strategy for the region. I still don't think we've managed to come up with an answer for how to halt the present situation in a way that feels like the Israelis feel that the hostages have been returned, that there is some protection from Hamas, and that the killing therefore stops and some kind of rebuilding happens in Gaza. The political solution you're talking about will happen, but there has to be a sort of immediate sort of geopolitical military bridge to that that makes each party feel somehow that something has been achieved. That's the wrong thing to say, given that what seems to be achieved is just awfulness. But something needs to happen that brings us to that political solution, right? And I still feel
ceasefire.
I don't know what that is. Well, yes, a ceasefire. But
it's
ceasefire.
It's going to be start with a ceasefire.
Yeah, and a ceasefire has to be on both sides. That is the thing.
I agree.
When I see many people on the street calling for a ceasefire, I agree with them. And the way I agree with them is that a ceasefire requires both sides to lay down their arms. But I do know that in that call, I hear, a lot of Jews hear, solely the denouncing of Israel as the stronger military party. And that might have some validity in it. But yeah, it would be good to hear, it would be good to understand that two sides do need to both lay down their arms for there to be a ceasefire.
When I say ceasefire, David, I mean both sides need to stop firing on each other. Right, we'll move on to the next question. A few weeks ago, we had this question when we spoke about Shamima Begum. This is a question from Josh Calder Robinson, and he asks, I'm Jewish and I'm therefore eligible for Israeli citizenship. Does that mean that me and every other Jew in Britain could potentially be deprived of citizenship if the government of the day decides I have committed a crime incompatible with British citizenship? This is the $65 million question, David.
Is it? I don't think of it as... I thought the previous question was the $65 million question. I thought that was our big question. I know very little about Shamima Begum and the citizenship issue. I know she was stripped of her citizenship, not just because she'd gone to join ISIS, but also because she turned out to be a citizen of Pakistan. Is that correct?
Bangladesh.
I beg your pardon.
I'll give you a bit of background. So Shamima Begum was one of three East London schoolgirls that travelled to Syria in 2015 to join the Islamic State group, ISIS. She was born in the UK to parents of Bangladeshi heritage, and she went across there, married an IS fighter, ended up having three children. Tragically, none of them survived. And she had her citizenship stripped on national security grounds in 2019 by Home Secretary Sajid Javid at the time. And she remains in a camp in northern Syria controlled by armed guards. And she's effectively in no man's land.
Yeah. OK, so the question is, I don't know if it's a slightly cheeky question, if he actually thinks that Jews could be stripped of their citizenship if they commit a crime because all Jews are eligible for Israeli citizenship. Sorry, is Shamima Begum just eligible for citizenship of Bangladesh, or does she actually hold Bangladesh citizenship?
So what's interesting is that Shamima Begum is eligible for Bangladeshi citizenship in the way that all Jews, because of the right of return, are eligible for Israeli citizenship, just like actually kids and my grandkids and their kids would potentially be eligible for a Pakistani citizenship because their great-great-great-great-grandfather set off from there one day.
Right, so that's interesting, particularly for me. I don't include Israel in the list of countries that I am potentially a citizen of, but I am a citizen of Britain and America because I was born there, and I am presently looking into becoming a citizen of Germany because I have a sort of right of return to Germany because my mum was born in Nazi Germany and was a refugee to this country, and so they offered that to me as well. And although there are very, very deep psychological reasons why I might want that in order to sort of defeat Hitler, I also don't want to stand in the horrible Brexit British queue at airports anymore. So that's why I mainly would get a German passport. So that I could be sent back to either country if I committed a terrible crime, presumably.
Oh, you could be sent back to neither of those, but just be left stateless in a desert somewhere because you have a right to another citizenship, or you've actually taken up another citizenship. You see, this really worries me. I'll tell you why this really bugs me, because what this has done is it has created two classes of citizenship. And interestingly, often when I'm having these rows within the Conservative Party, I don't always have a huge amount of support. But on this, the right of the party and individuals from the right of the party to recognise how this is an appalling decision. So of all people, Jacob Rees-Mogg believes that Shamima Begum should not have lost her British citizenship. And he wrote an article back in, I think it was earlier this year, actually, in February of this year, in which he said, and I do want to read this out, actually, not that I'm often quoting Jacob Rees-Mogg, but this really does need quoting. What he said was, the ability to deprive people who have a claim to another citizenship of their British passport creates two categories of Britain. Those with no right to another nationality are in the first class carriage. Whatever they do, they cannot be made an exile or outlaw and expelled from the country. On the other hand, those who themselves came to the UK or whose parents did so are in the second class carriage. They may be stripped of their citizenship even if they have never claimed another foreign nationality or even visited the country. This is a fundamentally racist policy, he says, as it denies the absolute Britishness of all those who are either recent immigrants themselves or their children. I couldn't agree more. You're either British or you're not British. And what we should be judged on is on the basis of our actions, not on the heritage of our families. So if two people go out and commit the same offence, then the concept of the rule of law basically means that both of them should be treated absolutely equally, not that one gets thrown out because their great-great-granddad came from some foreign lands, but another person doesn't get thrown out because their great-great-granddad didn't come from a land which still gives you the right to a potential citizenship.
Yeah, I agree with that. Can I just ask you a question, though?
Yeah.
The stripping of citizenship. So, for example, if a white person without any heritage in a foreign country had gone to fight for ISIS, could they be stripped of citizenship just because that's a bad thing to do or not? Are we saying that the stripping of citizenship requires some other country? Is that the thing?
Yes. So the basis of stripping of citizenship is not based on what you've done or alleged to have done. It's based upon where your family heritage is. That's why this is such a racist policy.
Yeah, I mean, it is a racist policy, although because I am American, if I did something terrible, I could be sent to America, I presume, which would not be a specifically racist thing in that particular case. But it just is discriminatory against people who hold dual citizenship, I guess.
But that's because you are a citizen of the United States, David. You've chosen to become a citizen of the United States.
Oh, I see. Okay, no, you're right.
But if you take, for example, if you take my grandkids now, who are now 1, 2, 3, whatever, 5 generations removed from when somebody traveled from some foreign land to come here, they have no idea of the land that their great-great-great-grandfather came from. They don't know it. They don't go to it. They don't speak the language. They've never taken up citizenship. They have no interest in it. If they go out and commit something which is against the law, why should they be stripped of their British citizenship? They're Britain's problem. Why should they not be dealt with by Britain's criminal justice system and be put in a British prison? Why do they need to be sent off into some desert somewhere and say, well, actually, you're Pakistan's problem now? Why is it that when the offspring of immigrants are good immigrants, there are immigrants, but when the offspring of immigrants become bad people, they're somebody else's problem? I mean, it's pretty pathetic, isn't it?
You're obviously right about that. I mean, I don't know if we're going to get into this particular aspect of it, but I believe that you have been accused of suggesting that British Israelis who have fought for the IDF should be placed in a similar situation and should possibly be stripped of their citizenship and sent to Israel, or is that a mischaracterization?
Oh, no, that's complete bullshit. That was the article that was running the Jewish News, for which I sued them, and they nicely paid me damages, which I enjoyed handing over to various charities.
That's good. But what did you say? Because presumably you said something, possibly to illustrate Shamima Begum's case, about how theoretically that could happen. Is that what you did? Because I didn't read the article.
No. So it wasn't the Shamima Begum case. What I said was that if you are a dual national and you've taken up dual nationality, one of the things that you need to do is be clear about which nationality, which armed forces or which nationality you should join. I'll give you an example. And this was the example that I gave in the House of Lords. There are lots of people in the United Kingdom who are British Pakistani and are entitled to a Pakistani nationality. There are lots of people who are British Indian and who would be entitled to hold an Indian citizenship of some sort. And the concern that I raised was, say if there was a war that broke out between India and Pakistan, as often does, I would not be comfortable with British Pakistanis and British Indians joining the armed forces of Pakistan and India, fighting it out, and then subsequently coming back here to try and live together in the same communities. I think it's wrong. And that's why I said that if you are a British national and an American national, or a British national and an Israeli national and a British national and a Pakistani national, you should only ever fight for the British armed forces, not for that second country. Because I think, because we are a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious society, I think us fighting for these other countries where we may come into conflict with each other is not the right way. The best way you have unity in Britain is that if you're going to fight for any armed forces, you fight for the British armed forces, or you don't fight for any of the others. I hold that view very strongly, David.
I have never given that any thought whatsoever, so I don't have much to say about it, because the last thing I would ever do is want to fight for the British Army, and then certainly not another army on top of that. That would be, what a silly idea, that I might want to do more fighting than was already available to me. I presume, therefore, you would say the same about a British Palestinian who decided to go and fight the IDF in the streets of Gaza. You would feel the same thing, that they shouldn't be doing that.
Completely, completely unacceptable, David. I mean, for me, this is really personal. Both my maternal and paternal grandfather served in the British Armed Forces. I have a child back in uniform. This is really important to me as part of my country. If we're going to fight, we're going to fight for the British Armed Forces, and you don't go off fighting other wars around the world. Because I think when you come back for them, as we've already started to see recently, it causes needless tensions between communities that don't need to happen.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I think we should move on. We had this question from Keith Hammond, who describes himself as a secular Jew. Isn't that the second one we've had of them? Anyway, all Jews are atheists, basically. Why didn't and don't
British Muslims... You're going to upset so many Jews by saying that.
I'm not. Honestly, I do lots of material about it. 50% of Jews who identify as Jews are also atheists, which is much larger than any other group. Why don't British Muslims and Muslims worldwide collectively mourn for the 377,000 Muslims recently killed in the current war in Yemen? It would seem that if fellow Muslims kill each other around the world, it doesn't seem to spoil Ramadan. That was something you talked about how British Muslims would be thinking about Gaza during Ramadan. It doesn't seem to spoil Ramadan for British Muslims, but Gaza does. The obvious takeaway is it's because Israel is involved and Jews. Why is this? I mean, I think that's putting it quite simplistically, but we did get other questions which referenced other conflicts or other places that Muslims around the world are suffering, including in China, including in Pakistan, including in Myanmar. We have talked about this, about the way that Israel-Palestine feels, and it may be unfair, but it certainly feels like it's very much at the top of the agenda for Muslims who want to speak out about the suffering of their community elsewhere in the world. But there are other places where that is obviously going on that seem quieter. So why don't you begin?
I think, first of all, answering kind of Keith's question, it isn't because it's Jews. I think you have to make a really big distinction between Jews and Israel. When people talk, I always make it clear when I talk about Israel, I don't even talk about the country Israel. I talk about the Israeli government, the current Israeli government. There have been Israeli governments in the past who have been incredibly supportive of trying to find a solution towards the two-state solution. So I think, Keith, it's important to draw a distinction between Jews, Israel, and the current Israeli government. And I think when we have these conversations, it's important to do that. I have huge objections to the current Israeli government. And I'm sure most Jews in this country would have real reservations about a Netanyahu government and his far-right kind of extremist cabinet. As far as Muslims are concerned, let me tell you about Ramadan a couple of years ago. Ramadan, I think it was 2020, 2021. It was in the middle of the whole COVID stuff that was happening. And yet the Yemen war was happening. And in the middle of all of that, the United Kingdom decided to reduce its aid contribution to Yemen by something like 60%. There was huge uproar within the Muslim community because this was in the middle of COVID, in the middle of a famine in Yemen, and we had just reduced our aid contributions by 60%. And that year, that Ramadan, a number of charities, including Islamic Relief, led a huge campaign, and we saw an 80% rise in donations for the Yemen campaign. But what was interesting was that when we were jumping up and down and screaming about Yemen, Muslims, British Muslims, nobody else in the country really cared. I think the distinction between Muslims not caring about other issues and Muslims caring about Palestine, it isn't that. What you find is Muslims do care about what's going on in Yemen, do care about what's going on in China, do care about what's going on in Myanmar. But actually, it doesn't normally capture the public interest in the way that this war has, where if you look at people who are protesting on the streets, they're not Muslim. The overwhelming majority of people protesting on the streets are just ordinary fellow Brits, including actually Jewish people. I mean, let me give you my own kind of examples of where I've raised issues. I've consistently raised issues about our relationship with Saudi Arabia. There have been huge debates in Parliament about the arming of Saudi Arabia, the amount of money that we give to them and the amount of arms that we sell to them. I mean, I want to quote to you actually from a parliamentary debate on Yemen. And this was said, bombs supplied by Britain and America are dropped from planes built by Britain and America, flown by pilots trained by Britain and America, and kept in the sky with British and American maintenance. This war would not be possible without that support. These violent deaths would not occur without that support. And a humanitarian crisis on this scale would not have happened were it not for that support. That is a debate on Yemen in Parliament.
So I don't know much about Yemen, which is part of the problem. It's about the 15th time I've said I don't know much about. But anyway, I have some facts here about Yemen, which is interesting, because according to the facts I have here, Yemen is actually the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Around 2.7 million children are suffering from acute malnutrition, and two-thirds of the population, or 21.6 million Yemenis, remain in dire need of assistance 5 million are at risk of famine, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's extraordinary figures, really. And you're right, it is not the war, it is not the conflict that makes the front pages. And there may be lots of reasons for that, but actually one of them is to do with what you said, I think, which is about the people marching on the streets, all of whom I actually respect, and I think all of them have good motivations for wanting peace. But a lot of them are, as you say, not Muslim. They are white progressives. And white progressives, in my opinion, they don't quite know what to do with wars and terrible situations and conflicts like happen in Yemen. Because what they see is essentially Shia and Sunni, two different types of Muslims or whatever, attacking each other, Saudi Arabia getting involved. And it feels to them like, oh, we don't really have an obvious bad guy here from our point of view. Whereas it is the case that in the imagination of the white progressive, Israel is a very easy bad guy. Israel, in their terms, is white, which is a kind of weird idea because a huge amount of Israel are Mizrahi Arabs or Sephardi Jews, who are literally brown people, and they are colonialists and all the rest of it. And in the way that the modern progressive thinks, which is all about where is the power, it's much, much easier to think, right, the powerful, the victimizers are Israel, and the victimized are Palestine and are the Muslims. And whatever the truth of that, and I'm not saying that isn't true, it's easier for the white progressive to think, I know who to take the side of, I know who to ally with. It is not easy to do that with Yemen. It is not easy. It appears to be not even easy to do that with China and the Uyghurs, which, by the way, is mental. I think with Yemen, it probably is quite difficult. With China, where I've been, I have been there. I have been to Xinjiang province when this was started. It's apparent that the Chinese government, who are vastly powerful, are trying to squash a whole culture and to culturally repress an entire Muslim culture there, and with camps and re-education and all sorts of terrible things. And that should be clear. But again, I think there's this slight resistance to criticising essentially people of colour who might be suppressing other people of colour.
Yeah, I won't travel to China, David. I just think it's appalling what is going on there. And I think it's appalling that large parts of the world are completely silent about effectively what are concentration camps that have been set up for Uyghur Muslims and the way in which the people forcefully enter their homes. They live in their homes. They take their children away from them. They test them by forcing them to eat products that would be, for example, forcing them to eat pork. And there have been trips where China keeps offering these trips to come over and see that it's not all true. And I'm like, I'm not even prepared to take part in this propaganda that you put out there. But what's interesting is the number of parliamentarians who do speak out about China, the number of parliamentarians, actually, certainly on the conservative benches, who have now been sanctioned by the state of China because of the fact that they speak out on what's going on with the Uyghur persecution. In fact, one of the questions that I do regularly raise is, how can you take issue on what's going on in places like Palestine if you're not also prepared to take issue with what's going on with the Uyghur genocide? I've raised it in Parliament. I've spoken with the Uyghur community in the United Kingdom, who often feel like that the United Kingdom government doesn't support them. I would say that there's only one distinction that between China and Saudi Arabia and Israel, and that is that neither China nor Saudi Arabia project as liberal Western democracies, whereas Israel does project as a liberal Western democracy. It professes to be of a higher standard. And then when the world holds it to a higher standard because of the standard it set itself, it can't then complain to say, well, don't hold us to a higher standard than the dictatorships that are around the world like Saudi Arabia and China.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Although I think Jews feel, I'm often saying this, what do Jews feel? I think Jews feel, even not particularly pro-Israeli Jews, that Israel, certainly presently, and maybe for a while, but certainly presently, is seen as like the biggest villain on the world stage. That idea of like who is the worst enemy and who therefore do we have to spend most of the time trying to agitate against, it is a bit odd if you think that like there are these other countries that just because they don't profess to be a liberal democracy, oh, then we won't bother to protest them. That seems a bit odd to me. Yep. But I guess I wonder whether you think I'm at all right about the wider thing, which is that away from our own communities, the grasping of this as the thing that people who want to protest are most going to protest about, and that those people are not necessarily Muslims, or some of them are Jews or whatever, is partly due to it seeming like there's a clearer to white people. I'm going to use the phrase, to white people, it seems like there's a clearer goodie and a clearer baddie than, say, in Yemen. I wonder if you think that's at all right.
Yeah, where I would agree with you is I think in the country generally, if I was to raise concerns about what was going on in Yemen, there'd be far less interest than if I was to raise concerns about what was going on in Palestine. And it's probably because people feel like they understand what is going on in Israel and Palestine in ways that they don't understand what's going on in Yemen. Yeah. Remember, the one thing we always have to go back to, which I suppose isn't true of China and the Uyghurs, is that we've got a dog in the game. You know, the Balfour Declaration was invented here. And the Balfour Declaration was always about creating a homeland for two sets of people, and that in the creation of the State of Israel, we wouldn't impact on the people who were already living there. And in that sense, we didn't implement the second part of that Balfour Declaration. And so to some extent, we do as British citizens have a right to say to our governments, to say, we're part of the we've created part of this problem here, and we therefore have a responsibility greater than we do to other parts of the world where we may not always have created the problem, i.e. China, where we do have a greater responsibility to do something about it.
Maybe. I mean, I think that would be true if it wasn't for the fact
that,
you know,
in Kashmir,
America,
by the way.
And in America and all over the world, this conflagration is dominating headlines, certainly as far as foreign policy goes. I think one reason is also to do with religion. Frank Skinner, who is a devout Catholic, is definitely more interested in this conflict than in other conflicts, partly because he genuinely thinks that Israel, Judea, Palestine, whatever, whichever part you want to call it, is the Holy Land. And our culture, the Judeo-Christian culture, indeed the Judeo-Christian Muslim culture, the Abrahamic religious culture, is wrapped up in legends to do with that country in a way that obviously it's not in China or Yemen. So that, I think, is also part of it. I think we should move on.
Yeah, we should. So let's move on to the next question, David. Here's a tricky one from Phil Turner. And you are the best expert to answer this, so you can't say I don't have the detail on this. So the question he asks is, if I condemn Israeli policy regarding settlements, does that make me an anti-Semite? I mean, this is a huge question. And over the last 6 months, there's a constant debate about what is anti-Semitism, what isn't anti-Semitism when it comes to Israel. So over to you.
Mm. Well, I think the answer is obviously no. Specifically, the answer is no regarding settlements, actually. I think much more complicated is, certainly for most Jews, is the condemnation of Israeli policy as regards, say, the conduct of the war in Gaza or anything else that could be considered to be Israel doing stuff in self-defence. So the settlements are clearly not happening in self-defense. The settlements are perpetrated by zealots, by mad religious zealots who believe in Old Testament prophecies and Old Testament ownership of Israel solely for Jews. And they have been supported by the far right in Netanyahu's government, and indeed by Netanyahu, for lots of political reasons. But they are clearly unacceptable. They are illegal, I believe, in international law. And criticising them, to answer the question, saying they should not happen, they should be controlled, and indeed the land should be returned to the Palestinians that has been colonised by settlers, that should just be done, and is definitely not anti-Semitic. The larger question here, which Phil Turner, I think, is sort of inching towards, and which does involve a slightly insidious thing, is the notion very prevalent on the left, and maybe prevalent a bit in your world, which is not the left, but is certainly the world that looks at this conflict in certain ways, is the notion that any criticism of Israeli policy will be immediately called anti-Semitic. And I think the answer to that is it will be called anti-Semitic in certain quarters. The response to that is too diverse to say, which people do say, and they tend to say it in a way that I find kind of just annoying, that, oh, you can't criticise Israel without someone calling you an anti-Semite. No, you can't criticise Israel without some people calling you an anti-Semite. Members of the Netanyahu government, some very pro-Israel people in America. But meanwhile, Miriam Margolis has just done the most incredible rant for the Jewish Council of Australia, saying Israel is terrible, all Jews should condemn Israel, I feel ashamed of Israel, blah, blah, blah. And she's Jewish. I know some Jews will say, oh, she's a anti-Semitic Jew, but that's too complex a psychological thing to pass, really. So the point is that, yes, some people will use it Some people will weaponize the idea of criticizing any Israeli policy as anti-Semitic. People do ask me a lot, oh, how can you tell the difference between whether something's anti-Semitic or anti-Zionist? I do, or anti-Israel. I do have a hack. I actually have a hack, which is a tip you can use, which is look for the ancient trope. And here's an example of something that I would consider to be that. At a march in 2019 in Hyde Park, when there was another incursion between Israel and Gaza, someone was carrying a placard with a picture of Jesus on it. And Jesus was on the cross, and on that placard, someone had written, "Don't let them do it again." And the question you have to ask is who is them in that placard? Who does them represent? And it clearly doesn't mean Benjamin Netanyahu and the present Israeli government and the IDF, because they weren't there in AD 33 cheering for Team Barabbas. And so I think if you can say that them means the Jews, the eternal Jews in that placard, then that has strayed, at the very least, into anti-Semitism rather than anti-Israel critique.
I agree with you. I think we do need something, though, David, a kind of racist or not racist app where you can put it in and say, is this anti-Semitic or is this not anti-Semitic? Because for me, I mean, I've always felt really comfortable in this space because I choose my language really carefully. I think deeply about what I'm about to say. I think about the hurt that it could potentially cause. I never use the word Zionist. I never make references to Hitler and the Holocaust. I just think there are certain things you can, maybe it's the lawyer in me. I just think there's a way in which you can frame conversations without having to be nasty about it and without having to be offensive about it. But I do know, and if I could repeat to you the conversations that I've had over the last 6 months, the number of people who are absolutely petrified of speaking about the Israel-Palestine issue because they think they're going to be called an anti-Semite. Being called an anti-Semite, by the way, David, is career ending. And I do think that that's why when you do call somebody an anti-Semite, you've got to be absolutely clear that you are sure that what they have done is anti-Semitism, because it is a word that's now being overused, abused and manipulated in a lot of ways. It's weaponized. And when you start using it for Jews or you start using it for IDF soldiers, ex-IDF soldiers, Holocaust survivors, descendants of Holocaust survivors, rabbis, Jonathan Glazer, when everybody suddenly becomes an anti-Semite, then the real anti-Semites, how do we pick out who they really are? So I think that one of the tasks I'd like you to do, David, is start to be really clear and authoritative and almost become the authority on what is anti-Semitism and what isn't anti-Semitism. Because I tell you, the people who are currently the authority on that, people like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, they are not the right people to be advocating on this or to be the arbiters on this.
I think I am, because I get a lot of people talking to me about it every day, about not specifically this, but talking to me about anti-Semitism and Jewish representation and identity and inclusion and all the things around anti-Semitism. I don't know that it is career-ending. If it was career-ending, I think I can say this, George Galloway would not be in Parliament now, and I'm not calling George Galloway an anti-Semite, but he has been called an anti-Semite, I believe, Rachel Johnson, and he is suing her for calling him an open Jew hater. And obviously, we would never say anything like that about George. But the point is, he won that election. He is in Parliament. His career is not over, nor is it over on various channels that he's always on talking about Israel, Palestine or whatever. So I think the world it is now, to be honest, that there's almost nothing that you can be called that will end your career, because the world is too fragmented for career ending. There are many people that we could look at, and I'm not going to mention any of them now because some of them used to be friends of mine, but they were accused of terrible things, and now they've gone on to still have careers in parts of the internet. So I don't know really about the career endingness. I mean, people chuck about a lot of words. They also chuck around the word Islamophobe. They chuck around the word racist. That happens a lot. Anti-Semite is another one of those words, and I accept it. I don't think it's any more career ending than any other of those words.
The only thing I would say to you is, and again, we have to be careful about what we say, because obviously we don't want to be sued for this. George does not sit in a mainstream political party, and George does not have a media presence on a mainstream channel. And so when I say career ending, what I say is mainstream career in a mainstream political party. You can actually be an Islamophobe and still be in a mainstream political party. It's impossible to be an anti-Semite and be in a mainstream political party these days, even if you look at
Lee Anderson had to leave the Conservative Party. I know he didn't leave the Conservative Party in a way that felt like they were really kicking him out for his Islamophobia, but he did leave. He's not there anymore. He obviously said something that was easily considered Islamophobic, and he's left.
Yeah, but he wasn't kicked out, David. There's a big distinction.
Well, yeah, but it's not, I don't think it is that big a distinction.
There's a big distinction between being kicked out and leaving.
Here's what I'm saying. I think Saida feels, which I just disagree with, that saying that someone is an anti-Semite is like the top of the tree of not allowable things in the modern era. And I can promise you it just isn't. It might be in certain quarters. It's always the way in the 360-degree version of the world. It might be in certain parts of the Conservative Party. But really, I mean, for example, Elon Musk has opened Twitter up to being the most ferociously anti-Semitic space possibly that has ever existed, more so than when the Nazis were around. It's unbelievable the kind of anti-Semitism is on there. Elon Musk is the most successful man in the world. Now, I'm not saying Elon Musk is an anti-Semite, but I think it's undeniably true that he remodeled Twitter, and I don't see that it's really caused him any problems. So it depends on what space you're existing in.
And yet, David, when Elon Musk has done that, he's welcomed into Israel with open arms. And when I see Israeli politicians and others who say they oppose anti-Semitism and care about the Jewish community associating with people like the Prime Minister from Hungary, Orbán, they consider people who are clearly anti-Semites their friends. It undermines the fight against anti-Semitism. It undermines those who care about fighting this form of racism. And the overuse of the word anti-Semitism against people who are not anti-Semitic, but actually are anti this Israeli government, again, undermines the fight against anti-Semitism. So how do we deal with that issue?
I mean, I agree with you about that. And I think that is a good example, by the way, of how the Israeli government don't care about the ways in which anti-Semitism works in the rest of the world. I think they sort of don't care about that or don't even think about it, because then they wouldn't have had Elon Musk welcomed with open arms.
Right. Do you want to move on to the next question?
We had this question from Mike Doeck, who is a British Jew and an atheist. If you believe in the continued right of Israel to exist, does that not make you a Zionist? And I don't think it does particularly. So for people who don't know, I have gone on about this a lot. I see myself as a non-Zionist. And the reason I use the word non is that I won't use the word anti, because I think Jews are so often split into that gap. You see it in Miriam Margolyes' speech that she did, where she is so angry and so smeared in her own mind and so ashamed of Israel. She's a deep anti-Zionist. She's so connected to Israel. She feels so connected to it that she feels so deeply ashamed. Like it's her fault. Her fault that this is happening, because the thing in her that connects her as a Jew to the Jewish state feels so powerful in her. I don't feel that at all. My relationship to Israel is, as a woman said when she came up to me after seeing the documentary about Jews Don't Count, is she said, thank you for being the first Jew to ever stand on any kind of public platform in Britain or wherever and say, you know, it's a foreign country, right? Which is really just, that's what how I feel about it. It's like, it's a foreign country. And if we are a minority, if Jews are a proper minority, then we have to behave like a proper minority in relation to our, as it were, heritage country, right? Which is to say, yeah, we live here now, and that's a foreign country, and we've got some cultural association with it, but we don't spend all our time thinking about it. And if I went up to Phil Wang, a very good comedian friend of mine of Chinese heritage, and said, probably all the time you're thinking about China, and by the way, I'm not even going to speak to you unless you tell me what you think about China and the Uyghurs, I would be being a racist. And that is why I don't feel this particular strong connection with Israel. But I believe in its right to exist. I don't believe that it's my spiritual homeland. I believe its right to exist because there are 7 million Jews who live there. And I don't think they should be scattered or die or have their state dismantled, because they just do. And the way that I think countries have existed or come to exist in the 20th century, which is when Israel did, it's often involved terrible displacement and fighting and violence, and terrible things happen for countries to exist. And that doesn't mean that where we are now, it means that everything should be reversed and that country should be taken down. That would be silly in terms of loads and loads of countries. wouldn't work. And so I think it has a right to continue to exist.
I agree with you. I think Israel has a right to be a state within the 67 borders. And I completely agree with UK policy on this, that there should be two states and that Jerusalem should be a shared capital. West Jerusalem for Israel, East Jerusalem for the Palestinians, and that Tel Aviv is the capital of Israel. I think these are very clear, long-standing positions now. And I think anybody who thinks that they're going to dismantle the state of Israel, or anybody who thinks that they're going to dismantle the existence ever of a Palestinian state, those positions are extremist positions. And whether they're held by Jews or Muslims or Israelis or Palestinians, we've got to be prepared to say, no, it's 67 borders. That's the UN position. That's the internationally recognized position. And that's the position that even most in the Muslim world would now recognize. Those are the borders and those are the positions that we go back to. But I suppose for me, I'll tell you how I define Zionism, and I could be completely wrong. Zionism for me is a political manifestation of Judaism, just like Islamism is a political manifestation of Islam. And there are many political manifestations of Judaism. At one end, it is actually, I want a Jewish homeland in the place where we as the chosen people, this was supposed to be our land. And that's a version of Zionism. At the other end is, actually, we're going to have this extended Judea and Samaria. We're going to take parts of Jordan. We're not going to have a Palestinian state. We're going to take parts of Syria and Saudi Arabia and everywhere else. And actually, this is all our land and we've got to do it because this is what will then lead to whatever, the second coming. Yeah, complete bonkers, right? And Islamism is exactly the same. There are some people who feel like it's like the AK Party in Turkey. At the extreme end, it's ISIS. So I think that you've got to be really careful when you use the term Islamism or Zionism. What does it actually mean? What are you referring to when you talk about it in those terms? And there are extreme versions of Zionism and Islamism, whether it's the extremist settler movement or ISIS. But both on the other end of the scale, we should be able to have a debate about people saying, yes, I'm a Zionist or I'm an Islamist. And it shouldn't be a swear word.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. And I really don't like the way that Zionist has just become like a bad word, even though I don't see myself as one. As far as I understand it, and I am presently doing a documentary about Theodor Herzl, who was the founding father of the idea of Zionism. It's basically just the belief, well, his belief, which is very interesting, is that Jews are not safe wherever they are in the world, and that he was right to some extent in that he was coming up with this idea at the end of the 19th century. And so he predicted, I guess, the Holocaust. And his sense was, after the Dreyfus affair, was that Jews were not safe in Western Europe. And so the only way to solve that, in his mind, was to create a state where Jews could protect themselves. Now, I think that's got all sorts of issues, and it's very interesting that at the heart of the history of the state, there is this sense of paranoia. This is this sense of like insecurity, and that we need primarily to be in a bunker protecting ourselves. I think that is, to some extent, sealed in with the idea of Israel. But I think that the idea that Jews, who are a very small, very historically persecuted minority, should have a state may not be something that I even think myself, because I'm an atheist, so I don't even think that the idea of people being bound together in statehood via religion is necessarily a good thing. But I don't think it's a thing that should be instantly thought of as evil, which seems to be what's happening. The idea that it's just evil to think that Jews might have one small state the size of Wales that they feel protected within, that seems to me to be not an inherently evil idea, even though I agree with you, it's had extreme manifestations.
Talking about bunkers, you look like you're in a bunker. Where are you? You look like you're in a prison cell, David.
Yes, I've been put in prison and I've been sent back to America and then Germany by the British government for crimes against
Free Badil. I'm running the campaign.
For crimes against podcasting. No, I am doing a documentary. But I'm doing a documentary at the moment about, incredibly, it's a weird time to do it, about Theodor Herzl, because I don't really know anything about him, and I wanted to know about him, and I was interested in the people who are making this documentary wanted someone who was non-committal about the idea of Zionism. It's not a piece of propaganda, it's a piece of history. And it's actually really, really interesting. So I'm in Paris and I'm going to Basel tomorrow, where the first World Zionist Congress was. And then I'm going to Vienna and then Budapest.
I've really enjoyed today's podcast, David.
Yeah, it's been interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it's been great. So thank you, listeners, for the questions. Please keep sending in your questions for us. What's interesting is that a lot of them have been from Jewish people. So, hey, my co-religion is Muslims. Can you start getting some questions in?
Yeah, that would be a good thing. I'd like to have some more questions from Muslims. They're mainly, as you say, from Jews and old agnostic white men, as Danny Young described himself.
We're going to have another Q&A hopefully in a couple of weeks. The email address is podcast@instinctproductions.com, or you can send the questions to us on Twitter @AMuslimAndAJew.
Thank you very much. And by the way, thank you very much, Saeeda. Ramadan is now over, so let me be the first to say Eid Mubarak to you.
Thank you, David. Khair Mubarak.
Muslim and a Jew, Go There was brought to you by Instinct Productions.